conflict in Syria is a human tragedy. There's no doubt about that. But one of the problems is it seems so distant from our lives that for many Americans it's not an issue of importance. And then for those that it is an issue of importance, it seems so remote that we don't have much impact or any ability to affect what's happening. With the panel that we have here tonight, we hope to provide some different perspectives, some different points of view on the U.S. media and also on the U.S. government and the policies about a very complex and confusing situation. And being a member of the communication department and teaching and researching media, I would argue that the media coverage all but encourages avoidance of the issue. Or if you follow it, how would you possibly understand it if you're not an expert in Mideast studies? Syria is involved, the Baathists, the Sunnis, the Shia, the Alawites, the Yazidis, other Christian sects, Saudis there, Qatar's there, Turkey, the Kurds, ISIS, al-Nusra, which has now changed its name to the Levant Front, al-Qaeda, the Syrian Free Army, Iran, Israel, Russia, the United Nations has weighed in. When we're done, we're all going to give you a quiz, just like in class, and you're going to identify and define each one of those groups. And that's only part of it. The New York Times reports that there's 20 groups, 12 of which have been vetted by the United States as official opposite forces. So 12 out of the 20 groups fighting, the U.S. is vetted. Whatever democratic opposition that existed in 2011 has long ago been hijacked or armed. In fact, so much so that it's the front page of the Los Angeles Times a month ago reported that the Pentagon-financed opposition fighters were fighting against the CIA-backed opposition fighters. So the CIA and the Pentagon arms two different groups in Syria, and they were fighting each other. The major funder for the White Helmets, which I think one of our panelists is going to talk about, is the United States Agency for International Development. For many, it's unclear if it's a civil war or if it's an armed intervention by outside forces. And again, let me repeat, the media, in this case, the commercial media, does not help us at all to understand this. It confuses us, and it legitimizes both U.S. policy and U.S. goals. Every once in a while, some things come out. About a week and a half ago in the New York Times, they explained in some detail about how the Syrian Free Army was working with al-Qaeda and ISIS. The easiest way to proceed is to demonize Assad and emphasize the humanitarian crisis, and there's probably some validity to that. But I just ask everybody, even if you're not a history major, to think about what happened when they demonized Hussein, or demonized Ortega, or demonized Bishop, or demonized Noriega, or demonized, if you want to go all the way back, to Ho Chi Minh. Never, ever, in any case, when someone was demonized, did the United States intervention benefit the people of that country. And I would defy anybody to give me an example of that being true. So be careful, even if it's justified to demonize someone. Some say, ask the Syrians what they want. The interesting thing is depending on your point of view, you will find a Syrian that will say exactly what you want them to say. It'd be like asking somebody, what do the American people want? Remember the pollsters that said how the vote was going to go? Right? 50% of the people voted for this group, 50% of the people voted for that group, and another 50% didn't vote at all. Now you add all that up and it doesn't make any sense, but you find an American that speaks for the American public opinion, right? And I'll sell you a hamburger. There's multiple positions here, and we're not going to hear them all from our panel. There's pro-Assad positions. There's pro-Assad, pro-Russian positions. There's anti-Assad, pro-Syrian opposition, pro-Syrian independence, favoring Russian intervention positions. There's anti-Assad, pro-Syrian positions. There's anti-Assad, anti-armed resistance, anti-U.S., anti-Russian positions. There's anti-Assad, pro-armed resistance, even with al-Nusra. There's anti-Assad, pro-U.S. intervention. The U.S. should institute a no-fly zone. Again, I would ask you to remember what happened when the U.S. did that with Iraq. My own feeling is, as American citizens, a simple, principled position we should begin with is there should be U.S. hands-off Syria. That should be the starting point. Some would argue differently, and we'll may hear that tonight from you or from the panel. The point is that reasonable, well-intentioned citizens can disagree, but there is an urgent need to be better informed, to discuss, and even to debate. So I want to thank all the sponsors of this panel tonight, my own Department of Communication and Creative Arts, the Center for Global Studies, the Union for Democratic Communications, the student chapter, it's a media workers and communications scholars national organization, Lambda Pi Eta, which is the Honor Society for Communication Students, and our guests from the Syrian American Well Association, which is decidedly anti-U.S. intervention and defends the sovereignty of Syria. Hoosiers for Progress is also here, and they are a co-sponsor, and we appreciate that, and I expect to hear more nuanced perspectives from them. I ask all of you to pay close attention, accept some new, maybe uncomfortable assessments, but be skeptical of all easy answers. Each speaker is going to take 12 or 15 minutes, and then when we're done, we'll have some time for some questions, and when we're done with the questions, we'll have some time for discussions. I want to start by introducing Qusay Ahmad. He's a Syrian-American, let me stress, he's a U.S. citizen, a member of the local Syrian-American Well Association, which is a national civic association that campaigns for Syrian sovereignty against foreign intervention. They consider the U.S.-supported moderate opposition to be largely non-Syrian terrorists. Sawa's met with Congress, other politicians, public and civic groups, and calling for an end to the conflict. And insist on a democratic, secular Syria. And we're going to begin, and I'd like you to welcome Qusay Ahmad from the Syrian Well Association.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for being here. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to be here. Thank you, Professor Arts. For a geopolitical reason, Syria always been a target for the colonies countries. Historically, Damascus is the oldest city in the world. It's 7,000 years BC. Historically, Aleppo is the oldest city in the world also. It's 8,000 years BC. Historically, Syria is the land of the civilizations. Also, historically, Syria is the land of the alphabet. What Syria is facing right now, it's not a civil war. Syria is facing a global war, also a global plot led by the United States against the Syrian country. I'm going to give you a little brief on Syria up till Assad took over. After the French occupation to Syria, the Syrian people were able to elect their first president in a democratic way, and that guy named, the president's name was Shukri al-Quwatli. It was in 1949. That president who was elected democratically by the Syrian, the CIA engineered a coup against him after a few months, and he was gone. Then we had a second, third, fourth, and fifth coups against Syrian president. Till the day of March 8, 1970, when a young man took over, his name is Hafez al-Assad. Since Hafez al-Assad took over the power, he worked hard to rebuild the country, to bring political stability to the country, to build a strong army, strong community, And he also worked hard to save the Syrian sovereignty and the Syrian dignity and the freedom of the Syrian choices. In the mid-70s, when USA and Israel was able to take the Egyptian president, Anwar Sadat, to sign a treaty with Israel, which called Camp David, the Syrian president, Hafez Assad, refused to sign because he considered it as a surrendering, not a peace treaty, because he was looking to have his lands back, the Arab land, the Palestinian, Syrian Golan Heights, and Lebanese South Lebanon land, and also the rights for the Palestinian refugees for returns to their homeland in Palestine. That's why Assad didn't sign the treaty. So since then, a sanction was put against Syria. Also, a terrorist group of the criminal Muslim Brotherhood start showing up in Syria in the mid-70s with the help of the CIA and some of the Arab country to work against the Syrian government. Early 80s, the Syrian people with their army were able to defeat those terrorists, the Muslim Brotherhood. Their leader ran away to the United States and to Great Britain, and they still till now. And that's terrorist groups supposed to be fought by the United States. So early in 1980s, American pilot F-16 was flying over Syria without the permission of the Syrian government. So the Syrian air defense shut down the airplane, and they captured the American pilot alive. Jesse Jackson, who was running for president back in the early 80s, he made a trip to Syria and met with Assad and asked Assad to release that pilot. Assad, he released him. Just to prove Syria does not want to escalate the issues with the United States. During this time, the CIA and the Syrian intelligence were in a good relation exchanging names of terrorists to be captured around the world. That was in the early 80s. Also in the early 80s, the Israeli invade Lebanon after taking a green light from the U.S. government. They invade Lebanon for two reasons. Reason number one, to kick the Palestinian resistance out of Lebanon. Reason number two is to defeat the Syrian army also, prevent them from stopping the civil war in Lebanon. The Israelis succeed of kicking the Palestinian out of Beirut, but they did not succeed of defeating the Syrian army. So the Syrian army, 1989-1990, was able to stop the civil war in Lebanon and build an army for the whole country and take the weapons from everybody who is not in the government. So the Syrian army succeeded in that one. Then after that, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. President Hafez Assad, he joins the international community to liberate Kuwait. So also was a good relation with the United States. Even with that, the Syrian people were still facing a sanction were put by the United States and the European community, European Union. So Assad died in 2000. And mercy on him, he brought safety to the Syrian people. Used to cross Syria from north to south, east to west, without showing your ID or seeing a checkpoint. Now, unfortunately, it's different. Then Assad died without naming his son, Dr. Bashar, to be a president. 60 days, the Syrian people voted for President Dr. Bashar Assad to be a president. So then he started reforming. Then in September 11 happened. That's kind of hold him back from continuing in his reform because he started facing pressure from the West and from the United States. Even the hijackers, they were from Saudi Arabia. None of them was from Syria. So then the United States government tried to attack Iraq after September 11 in Afghanistan. And even as I just said, the attackers, the hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. They didn't do anything about Saudi Arabia. They invade Afghanistan, then Iraq in 2003. Then Colin Powell came into Syria talking to Assad, asking him to do a few things, like staying away from Iran, staying away from the resistance in Lebanon and Palestine, and have a peace treaty with Israel the way Israel wants it. Of course, Assad refused to do that. Then Colin Powell told him, you have to know we have 150,000 American soldiers on your border, and so you will be next. Since that day, the NATO's country, led by U.S. and other Arab country, start what it's called the plot, international plot against Syria. And they start smuggling weapons to Syria. They start smuggling also a Muslim young men from all around the world, releasing them from jail, having them sign a piece of paper to go and fight in Syria, preparing for the Arab Spring. Assad was doing some reform back then, and then after the American invasion to Iraq, which held Assad from doing his reform, they killed the Prime Minister of Lebanon, Rafiq al-Hariri, in 2005. That's also kind of held back Assad from continuing because they accused Syria of killing Hariri, and Syria was the biggest loser of that. And everybody was pointing at Israel. They killed him for one reason, and very important reason for Israel to be, which is to let the Syrian army get out of Lebanon. Was the only way to kill al-Hariri and blame it on the Syrian. They succeed. So the Syrian army left Lebanon. So far, the embargo by the Syrian was still on the Syrian. And then in 2010, the Arab Spring started. Jordan and Turkey start building refugee camp and the border of, and their border with Syria, preparing for the Arab Spring. In March 11, the terrorists were in Syria as they received the order to start working against the government, killing people, bombing school, bombing university, transportation center, even the elementary school, they bomb it and they killed young kids. So, and first 6 months, the Syrian security forces were protecting these people, and then they had special sniper in between each other. They start killing each other to blame it on the government. So that's when the Syrian people asked the Syrian army to go after these guys and stopping them from killing the Syrian innocent people. That plot is led by the NATOs. The United States government, Turkey, and the Gulf country is supporting the terrorists. And Hillary Clinton mentioned that in her book, Hard of Choices. She said, we are the one, as the U.S. created Al-Qaeda and others. They start building refugee camps on the border, and they start what's called revolution, which is not on the border also. They were looking to have a zone, non-fly zone, on the border with Israel and Jordan. So could be the moving point against their government in Damascus. They failed to do that. They switched to the Lebanese border for the same reason. They failed to do that. They are now on the border of Turkey. Now also the Turkish army, they are in Syria, killing the Syrian, and they're not supposed to be there. If the United States looking to liberate the Syrians, there's a lot of people looking to be liberated. The Palestinian been under occupation for 50 years. Golan Heights been under occupation. South Lebanon under occupation. So they better get be liberated by the United States. In Syria, if the people against their president or their government, there is no president in the world will be able to stay for 6 years against those terrorists if his people were not with him. So the Syrian people with their national government, because they are against those terrorists who's killing everybody, they want to build three countries in Syria. They want to kick the Christian out of Syria for religion's reasons. They are bombing mosques, churches, forcing people at the Christian neighborhood to become either resident or either Muslim or being killed or get out of Syria. So the Syrian government asked the Russian government to help them against those terrorists. Because U.S. start what's called coalition against ISIS in August of 2014. ISIS extend its territory three times, triple than before. ISIS took over Palmyra city coming from Iraq, 3 hours driving under the vision of the American satellite, and they didn't prevent them from occupying Palmyra. Also, ISIS spread all over Syria because the United States many times dropped weapons for them, and also many times they bombed the Syrian army, as it happened in Deir ez-Zor in September. They killed over 100 Syrian army members, giving a chance to ISIS to take over their bases. The difference between the interfering of Russia and Syria and the United States, Russia came in with the request of the Syrian national government fighting ISIS, also bringing food and hospital fields to the Syrian. The United States till now is still refusing to deal with the Syrian government. How can you refuse dealing with the only government in the world fighting the terrorists? How can you refuse talking to this government or cooperating? So either you have to fight ISIS with Assad or the Syrian army, or you don't have to. So the situation right now need to be solved. How the United States and its allies in the Arab world in Turkey started this plot against the Syrian people, the Syrian country. They have to stop it by asking Turkey to close its border, by asking Qatar and Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries to stop arming and funding these guys. So United States, the superpower country, they are the only country who's able to do that. They started it. They can finish it. Syria was a free education, free hospitality, free everything in Syria. No taxes before the crisis. Right now, the Syrian people don't have food. They are refugees. Half of the Syrian people refugees out of Syria because of what the terrorists are doing. And unfortunately, U.S. government and other Arab allies helping those terrorists. Syrian people, they should be left alone to decide their future. They are the one who's able to choose their president or to not choose their president. In this little book, 480 pages of official letter was sent from the Syrian government to the United Nations, also to the Security Council, telling them what the terrorists are doing in Syria. All these letters being ignored by United Nations and the Security Council. So we want you to help us in Syria, to help the Syrian people, ask your Congress just to ask their president to take their hands out of Syria. As long as it's there, the killing will continue. Thanks for being here, and thank you, Mr. Art.
Our next speaker is Matt Poskosh, who is the director of Hoosiers for Progress. It's a community action group in Northwest Indiana. They've campaigned for democratic rights for citizens across Northwest Indiana, including on issues of the environment, healthcare, and peace in the Mideast. For me, Matt's an inspiration. He has a tireless commitment to social justice. I've got a great respect for his considered views, and I'm anxious to hear his comments on Syria, and I'm glad he was able to join this public panel. Do you want to...
Thanks, y'all, for coming out. It's more than I expected. That's a good thing. It's where it'd be panels speaking to the fellow panelists. But in all seriousness, though, this issue has commanded my attention at least for close to this whole year. I've kind of went through the greater part of the span of this conflict, remaining in willful ignorance. And then at some point, I had something of, to use a term I learned in at a Lutheran college, a road to Damascus moment. I realized I couldn't stand by idly and take a very dismissive view of many of the participants to this conflict, as well as not just the conflict itself, but now as it's entangled this whole geopolitical circumstance with Russia, with Turkey, and so on. So I'm going to approach this discussion coming from pretty broad principles. Basic respect for human rights, basic respect for international law. I think those are two points that we can all agree on is a line in the sand that we should not cross, period. And I know that a lot of parties have been guilty of a lot of atrocious things, but I think we should perhaps set up something of a hierarchy of sin for what's been transpiring. This conflict and the concurrent humanitarian crisis present a very clear threat to geopolitical stability, and not only a degradation of some of our basic norms of international law and humanitarian law, but also, I worry, it very much presents a gross generalization of the U.S. war on terror. The fact that now everything's terrorism is becoming a very dangerous precedent. And unfortunately, we can thank the United States for having set the precedent after the September 11th attacks. Of course, after September 11th, y'all remember the George W. Bush administration basically using this as a convenient cover for bypassing certain statutes of international law, which we had up until then at least tried to pay some lip service in respecting. Now, of course, if you are a suspected terrorist or suspected enemy combatant, somehow statutes concerning your rights as a detained enemy combatant somehow get thrown to the wind. You see this in Gitmo, and you see this with the targeted drone strikes in Yemen, in Syria, in which just being suspected of being a party to terrorism or simply at the wrong place at the wrong time somehow is a death sentence. It's very saddening to see, and to the extent that up until recently this was the tactic of the United States and its coalition partners seemed to be contained at just that. Now, unfortunately, this same rhetoric is being employed in the war now in Syria by multiple parties to the conflict. I don't want to point fingers just yet, just point out the obvious fact that the framing of this as simply a war on terror is something that we should take note of, and it's something that to keep an eye out in the near future. it should be beyond dispute that over the past 5 years, there has been gross violations of international law under the existing Geneva Conventions, under the precedent set with the Nuremberg trials. And these have been well documented, not just by parties who are conflict to it, but by internationally recognized independent observers. This goes for humanitarian groups like Doctors Without Borders. This goes for Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, as well as individual parties with their own agendas in labeling what they see as these flagrant violations. And I would like to at least make the argument in this short panel discussion, I know we can go probably about it on end all night, is that by and large, a lot of these atrocities are committed by one set of groups. Whether or not it's justified, we can perhaps leave to further argument, but by and large, by most estimates, again, from MSF and Human Rights Watch and other modestly recognized independent groups, it's being committed by at least the Syrian government and Russia. I'm not saying that all parties are blameless in this, but we should at least recognize it for what it is. The current sieges in Aleppo currently constitute, arguably by international standards, collective punishment, which is banned by the Fourth Geneva Conventions concerning the rights of civilian populations. ISIS, or ISIL, however you want to call it, has committed their own atrocities, including arguably similar forms of ethnic genocide, ethnic cleansing, against Yazidis and others, other ethnic minorities in Syria. Jabhat al-Nusra has committed its own sets of atrocities against ethnic minorities as well in the country. And even reprisal killings have been found amongst the Kurds and the FSA. But again, by and large, the current ongoing atrocities as they are occurring have been in areas currently under control by either the political opposition, by Jabhat al-Nusra, even Kurdish-controlled territories, and it's been by and large waged by two main actors, the Syrian government and Russia. I don't think we should be arguing what it's obviously going on as we speak right now. As to the bigger question is, how do we stop this? I've been very skeptical and hesitant of unilateral actions by the United States. I think we all can agree the United States has done a very horrendous job concurrently in not only setting the context to this crisis, but having added further fuel to the flames. I would agree with gentlemen here that some type of cooperation is necessary, but it cannot be a cooperation predicated on turning a blind eye to flagrant violations of international law. If people have broken these statutes, they deserve the full prosecution, when and all applicable, by independent bodies. If not the ICC, which Syria is not a member of the International Criminal Court, then the UN needs to take a much more serious role in designating independent investigators into these crimes, as they have committed and are continuing to be committed. And I know that one of the biggest obstructions to this right now is the governance structure of the United Nations Security Council in particular. Every time Russia tries to put something on the table, the UN vetoes it. Every time the US puts something on the table, Russia vetoes it. This crisis, I think, exposes the unfortunate stability of the United Nations as the body that we need it to be, which is when you are in conflicts in which two members of the Security Council are parties to, they're going to obstruct the other left and right in the conflict. And I would argue that we need to have a serious discussion of what's the role of the international community and the bodies that represent it in this conflict, including more particularly non-state actors in this conflict. When groups who do not have recognition in these bodies, such as the political opposition in Syria with the FSA or the Kurds, they have less degrees of freedom in trying to seek reparations for crimes that have been committed, or at the very least the same legal recourse that member states to the UN have. The UN's been trying to, over the years, with this breakdown of national borders and conflicts now that are dividing former nation states in two, like we see in Sudan, that we've seen in Iraq with sectarianism, we need to have a serious discussion of who has access to the same degrees of legal recourse in international recognized bodies. If it's just member states, then obviously this is a very asymmetrical conflict with asymmetrical recourses for the parties involved. And let's see, lastly, sorry, one of the problems I've been seeing, at least with the discussion amongst the anti-war movement in the United States, is that it seems that principles which used to be upheld uniformly only 10 years ago when we all were on the same side of the debate concerning U.S. Invasion of Iraq or the war on terror are now being disregarded in this new conflict in which, yes, the United States needs to be put up on trial for crimes it has committed, but now all of a sudden if other parties are waging their own war on terrorism, we take a very silent stance on it. I think it's going to be very counterproductive for us as an anti-war movement if the logic of the war on terror is being appropriated by other parties in this international conflict or sets of conflicts. And we need to ask ourselves quite clearly, like, what are our principles and values, period. If we stay silent on crimes being committed halfway across the globe while not at the very least listening to those who want to claim some recognition from the West as in needing of some basic solidarity when crimes have been committed against them, I think it shows the vacuousness and the bankruptcy of the peace movement itself. I've talked to many folks in Chicago with Jewish Voices for Peace, with members of the Syrian American community, and others who can disagree on what the course of action should be in Syria, but I think we should all agree at the end of the day that a life is a life, no matter which way you have it. And if somehow, because someone's a terrorist, or someone's suspected of sympathizing with terrorism, or living in areas under control of terrorism, that somehow the rules are no longer applicable is a very dangerous precedent to set. So with that, I kind of would like to leave more to the open end of the discussion. I just kind of want to lay out the general gist, and we could probably talk all night about the details of particular cases that need further mentioning and further debate, but I would leave it at that and thank the panelists for their participation.
Presenter is Christian Lutz. He's a graduate assistant in the Department of Communication as an instructor, and he's going to talk to us about some media coverage and other comments. So, Christian Lutz.
Firstly, I'd like to apologize for how quiet I am. I've kind of lost my voice. It's coming back, but this is about as loud as I get. So what I wanted to talk to you guys about tonight is media framing, and some of the panelists have mentioned it. Dr. Arts has mentioned it. What framing is, to frame something is to take a piece of our perceived reality and highlight it or exaggerate it in a way that brings to mind specific definitions or interpretations, a moral feeling or a justification for an action. One of the examples that Matt pointed out was the war on terror. How many things do we know that have gone under that umbrella? Whether it be, you know, there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and that justified our movement there, to now the war on terror as it affects Syria and our involvement in that country. So framing can happen through the stressing of some information, but also the exclusion of other information. For instance, Dr. Arts mentioned that the CIA and the Pentagon were both involved in Syria, and that's only recently come out in the New York Times, and I think the LA Times as well. So for this paper, what I looked at, I'm in the process of working on a paper. Currently, I've looked at only print media for the last year. There's an awful lot to go through, so I'm talking about a very small picture of the issue and the way it's framed. So how does the media framing impact us on a general level? Media are the agents of social communication by which the crisis is made public, according to Rayboy and Danaeus. So it distracts from the interests of the elite, oftentimes, and makes us feel that the actions we're taking are justified. So in Syria, one of the things that came up often when I was looking at print media and the things that were mentioned is children. They talked a lot about the deaths of children. We mentioned the bombing of schools. They talked about the child brides as a justification for going against the Syrian government, saying that they were enabling these things, and that's why we needed to be there, because this is a human rights issue and not necessarily that we have vested interest. One of the things that I also saw come up pretty frequently was the idea of democracy. To us, we have a very clear picture of what democracy means. And a lot of that comes from the framing of it in the media, in the films that we watch, in the books that we read, in the news stories that we hear. And one of the things that kept coming up is the U.S. Army and military actions as allies against terrorism, spreading democracy. And in part, that gave us a justification for being there, and it also spectacularized the issue. Lee talked about, Dr. Arts, I apologize, talked about the idea that we're distanced from situations, and that allows us to not really get invested, As Matt said, he was able to keep himself out of the humanitarian crisis that's going on in Syria because we don't really have to care about it here. We're shown that it's focused on a way that makes them the other. We vilified a government, and then we've also shown the people to be, if you look at the images that you see, shown the people to be living in dank places. They're dressed in a certain way. A lot of the same images appeared in different stories in the New York Times and Los Angeles Times specifically, where they were talking about the rebels that were fighting against the Syrian government and also with the Syrian government. The way that they're portrayed is more violent through the images than might necessarily be true, but because those are the images we're seeing, that's the idea we're getting, and that's they're using the framing in the images and also in the stories to kind of portray that. My last point that I want to make, I mean, the whole point is to pay attention to what you're reading. As Dr. Art said in the beginning, you need to think about what you're reading, what you're seeing, and the way that it's being framed and the ideas that are being given to us and what that means, who has vested interests in those, and what that means for the crisis that's going on. The last thing that I want to talk about is the idea of U.S. interactions in Syria currently. One of the things that I saw is, you know, we talked about, or they talked about bombing that shouldn't have happened, killing of civilians. One of the stories that appeared in all of the newspapers that I looked at was that the U.S. killing of Syrian citizens was human error. So they justified their actions in a way that made the soldiers look like they were on the side of justice, they're on the side of democracy, and it's being put into a light where this soldier's being portrayed as a hero, which isn't necessarily the truth. Because it's an American soldier, it's being framed in a very specific way. That's all I have. And Raquel is going to give us some more information about framing as it relates to infotainment.
The last presenter is Raquel Williams. She's the president of Lambda Pi Eta, which is our honor society, and she's also a teaching assistant and an instructor for our Department of Communication. And you're not going to use
it. I'm not doing
it. And she's going to talk about framing of audiovisual, the new media. Please.
The new media. So much like Christian, I am sorry that I appear to have a smoker's voice right now. I hope that you all can hear me. I will be as loud as I possibly can. So please forgive me. Thank you, fellow panelists, to everyone that came and showed up. Thank you, Lee, for hosting us. And thank you, Rick, for taping this. Thank you. Okay, so who is dizzy so far, right? Whose heads are spinning? A lot of you are unfamiliar with what is going on, and this has been a lot for you, I am sure. So what is the solution, right? So now you know that apparently you should be interested in Syria, because we told you that you should be interested in Syria. So what do you do? How do you become informed? I bet you a couple of you are thinking about going home and turning on Netflix and maybe typing in Syria and seeing what pops up. So what would pop up if you were to do that? There are, I think, three documentaries currently on Netflix right now, regarding Syria. However, the most controversial and well-known is called The White Helmets, cleverly named after the NGO, Syrian Civil Defense. So why is it, regardless of having heard two completely different perspectives from Kusei and from Matt, that we still have questions about the reality and we still are experiencing confusion of the situation? I think that is because, as Christian said, reality as such, I'm not going to get into the deep philosophical question of the nature of reality, right, because we don't have enough time. However, the way that reality, quote-unquote, is framed is largely determined by the stories that we listen to, and even if we have our own personal experiences, that reality or that version of reality is arguable as the correct one. So today I'm going to be focusing on entertainment media coverage, especially or particularly in the Netflix documentary, The White Helmets. So my larger goal here is to help you guys understand how the typical media consumer, the average American, the passive media consumer, might come to understand the role The White Helmets has in the crisis in Syria and, more importantly, the overall crisis in Syria. So first of all, I'm going to address The White Helmets, this organization, as an NGO. How many of you are familiar with the abbreviation NGO, because that's something that is used repeatedly, or actually know what it means? Okay, non-governmental organization, which is a funny thing to call them. because in an article last year that came out entitled "Syria's White Helmets: Fiction and Reality," the helmets receive vast donations from various governments, including the UK, Germany, Denmark, and the Netherlands. But their biggest donor, as already said, I believe by Matt, is the U.S. Agency for International Development, financing NGOs across the world. So how can you not be governmentally associated if you are being funded by such? U.S. State Department spokesman Mark Toner confirmed in last year that since 2013, the agency granted the helmets at least $23 million. In early 2016, we're going to back up a little bit, because think about where this documentary is being aired, right? Netflix. So in early 2016, earlier this year, Netflix announced a significant expansion, expanding to over 130 other countries. As it stands, the major exceptions are North Korea, Syria, and Crimea, where it is banned entirely from by U.S. law. So pretty much the opposition to anything that is shown on Netflix is non-existent unless they are streaming or using the dark web. So we're going to get into media framing of this issue. Christian already gave you a more general understanding of media framing. However, Robert Ettman, who our analysis of framing is based off of, he says the two most important aspects and functions of these frames are problem definition and the solution, or declaring a remedy. So that's what I'm going to be focusing on today. Problem definition in the White Helmets is very simple. There is a crisis in Syria, and people are dying. People are getting injured. Very simple. That's the issue. The solution, what do you think it is? It's in the White Helmets. It's right in the title. So it's even more simple than that. So good thing that these are the two most important, according to Ettman, because the entire documentary, which is, by the way, only 40 minutes, but I'll talk about that in a couple minutes of my own, they only make a shallow attempt at identifying any diagnosis, and that is only twice during the whole film when they mention, oh, it's the Russians, right after you hear zoom, which are loud, just jets, and then you hear the big explosion, and then the camera gets all shaky, and then you're panicking, right, because the music gets all intense, and then it's the Russians, and then they're running somewhere, and then a child, okay? So this is a sad attempt to put anything into context, which is the larger issue, right? Nothing at all in this 40-minute documentary is put into context for us. We just know there's a problem, and who's going to solve it? The White Helmets. Very reminiscent of a Batman movie or any other action movie we may see. So Ettman also says, sometimes one among the potential frames of a situation so thoroughly dominates the media that alternative readings become virtually irrelevant in politics. In these cases, the dominant frame, which we've been introduced to, produces extraordinarily one-sided survey results, and these in turn discourage dissenting politicians from speaking out, thus cementing the hold of the one frame. So this is why we are talking about this. Like, who cares how the media frames things? Well, because if there are any dissenting politicians, they are much less likely to speak out because the other people that would be listening or arguing with them are not primed for these. Another aspect of framing, as according to Ettman, culturally resonant frames use words and images that are more salient, which, if you don't know what that means noticeable, understandable, memorable, and emotionally charged in a culture. Magnitude taps the prominence and repetition of the framing words and images, so the dominant frames. So what happens in the White Helmets documentary is that they really appeal, as we've all said, to the fact that it is a humanitarian crisis and to family. So each time a member from the White Helmets says, my job is so important, my duty, my job, the sacrifice I'm making is so important, immediately following this, the documentary builds an association, because immediately after they make reference to any of the work they do in this organization, immediately following is a reference to their family, or an image of a child, or an image of their family. At the beginning, there is a little girl, a daughter of one of these members, who introduces himself like he was a part of the real world and tells all about his experience, and his name is up here, so he has a nameplate, so that way you feel extra tied to him, because now he has a name. And then he brings in, after he talks about the work that he does with the White Helmets, they bring in an image of his daughter putting his white helmet on his head. So it's very, very emotionally charged. The very first opening frame, though, if we're going to talk about resonance and salience, is of the most popular image thus far in news media of the crisis in Syria. And what is that image? It's of the little girl sitting by herself with the long hair, quote-unquote, rubble all over her. She's dusty, and she's just alone, and she looks scared, and that is just horrible, right? There are people who say that there have been multiple instances of this photo. That is how the entire documentary is opened, with this photo, this image that we've all seen if we've ever looked at a newspaper in the past, 6 months. So it's already very salient right from the beginning. By just 20 minutes into the movie, halfway through, 23 children are shown throughout the entire movie. There are 53, it's only a 40-minute movie, by the way, there are 53 direct and indirect references to family. So by indirect, I mean the word brother, sister, mother, father, daughter, these, need I go on. About 10 characters are introduced by names and even storylines. Three in particular, in which the documentary focuses, are members of the White Helmets. But again, we are introduced to these characters by name, so we are emotionally attached to them right from the get-go. And even while they're saving people, they'll call out, like, is so-and-so over here? But they'll use his name, or they'll say, have you saved so-and-so? I don't know, but so-and-so is upstairs, so we got to go save him, too. And it's just very emotionally charged, and we have an interest in them, which I thought was interesting. It seems more like a movie. There is one part about 26 minutes in where they talk about the miracle baby, quote-unquote. I don't know how many people have heard about the miracle baby, but it's one of the most horrendous parts in the entire movie, because they are literally pulling a baby from what appears to be a collapsing wall, and you're watching this. And this is, it's sad, because the first time that I watched it, I experienced almost no emotional reaction to it, because we were also desensitized from seeing these horrific instances over and over and over again. But anyways, this is used as a part of this documentary. So they pull out this baby from this wall, and they're screaming in the background, like, oh, thank God, thank God, thank God, God is good, God is good. And they take you through, and they say, we think it's the miracle baby. We call it the miracle child, the miracle baby. And then there's about 15 more minutes left in the documentary, and towards the very end, you're reintroduced to this baby. So you kind of get like, oh, good, I was wondering about that baby. What happened to him? So you have this sense of relief. But again, just very emotionally charged, and now it's very individualized, right? Because you only are caring about the story about the baby. You're not saying, why is this happening? Instead, you're just worried about the baby, or about the people that have been named, the 10 people that have been named, the 10 characters that you're now emotionally invested in. And that is troubling to me. So I'm going to move on, because I talked about how this seems much like an action movie, or much like a movie like for entertainment purposes. Infotainment, as understood by Diakishan Thasu, I hope I'm not slaughtering his name, is defined in a 2007 article as the globalization of a U.S.-style, ratings-driven television journalism which privileges privatized some word. So news about celebrities, crime, corruption, violence, and presents it in a form of spectacle, keyword spectacle, at the expense of news about political, civic, and public affairs. So I want to start off by saying that, first of all, the White Helmets were not originally called the White Helmets. They were named such by Western media. So when we hear the White Helmets, and when we see the White Helmets, there's a documentary about the White Helmets, these people that we've all heard so much about, it's almost like celebrity culture. And according to Thasu, centered on celebrity culture and laden with infotainment content, as social media gain greater salience in an age where news media are increasingly nuanced by such digital global networks as Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. They don't mention Netflix, but I would argue Netflix as well. The tendency to simplify and sensationalize information is pressing, especially in a convenient 40-minute documentary. So there are quite a few elements of infotainment that this documentary, unfortunately, fits beautifully into. One of them is speculation and talk. So much in common with a chat show. To me, like I already said, that was much more reminiscent of a reality show. So of The Real World, for instance, or The Office. That's a mockumentary style thing, except for actual documentaries. So it'll have footage, and then it'll get highly personal, and it'll just be an interview with me, just me, and then my name, okay? So, element of infotainment. Intense music. You better believe that at the beginning of this, it's a black screen, okay? And then there's, like, dark, eerie, dreary music, and then you hear, like, jets coming in, and then Netflix production in association with, and then you hear bombs going off, and you're just already emotionally, like, you're getting there, right? Which is another element of infotainment, intense music, if that's not the one I'm in. It is. And computer animated logos, which would be Netflix documentary, because, of course, it's not just the typical Netflix one. It's kind of all beaten up and, like, looks all worn out. So it fits this perfectly. Visuals and sound effects that are attention-grabbing. Obviously, if you hear jets, you're going to be listening. This music is emotionally charged. You have violins. You have, like, music that just goes really fast. It's fast-paced. So that way you are matching the emotion that they want you to feel. Visuals and sound effects that are attention-grabbing. This, I cannot have time to go into this, but it is important that we pay attention to camera angles, which would take a much deeper semiotic analysis than I have time to explain here today. But most of the way that any of the white helmets are portrayed are from a downward-looking angle, right? So if it was a video of me, I would be standing above you. And how do you feel when someone stands above you? That they are your authority, right? Which is why Lee probably told me, stand up, you will have more authority. But instead, I'm hiding behind my computer. So this is important. Colorful and poetic language, and you better believe that is a thing. Bloodbath, massacre, barrel bomb, bloodshed, etc. These are all terms that are used consistently throughout the entire thing. Glamorous anchors, though by my own standards, I wouldn't necessarily deem any of these men particularly attractive. They might be. They're all well-shaven, clean-cut, very well-dressed. So I suppose it could be glamorous on a relative scale. So, okay, what happens? So, Raquel, we know this. Get to your point, right? The trivialization of the real issue. As Matt said, terrorism is being appropriated. So this is what happens. So now Netflix needs to make some money, and this is easy. By the way, Netflix didn't send a production team to go film with the white helmets. They sent them out equipment and said, you guys film, and we'll edit. So that was also a money saver, too. As Kusei says, there is a different perspective. A lot of people online, I wish I had time to show you the opposing video, I don't. There are people who believe that the CIA and other government officials are directly responsible for the unrest in Syria. They are furious with Netflix about airing this documentary and just furious that they are framing the white helmets as these, like, saviors, these heroes, which they were called three times in this documentary. The whole situation, as described very eloquently by Vanessa Beely, a British expert focused on the Middle East, is an absolute perversion of humanity. So I'm really happy that all of you are here today. That was the best that I heard it described, because it's honestly just sickening. So tonight, although we didn't have time to address the question of reality, I wish that we could have. We've been introduced to some concepts and some different understandings of which the way that the general public might come to understand this super complicated, head-spinning crisis. These concepts are not only applicable to a vast majority of entertainment and news coverage, if there's even a difference anymore, but it's also useful in the critical assessments of the stories that we share with each other, okay? So with your friends, with your lovers, with your people. Outside of direct experiences, which I already say also have a bias in a certain frame, storytelling is the primary means in which we come to understand and thus interact with the world that surrounds us. Mass media has been referred to tirelessly, and I'm sure we're all annoyed with hearing it, as the dominant storytellers of our times, but it is so true. Currently, as you probably know, only 6 corporations own and therefore produce and determine the content of the news and entertainment that floods the average American. The content that has the potential to influence how we understand and interact with our world and the people, the humans, that are in it. So our point here is that it is imperative that we develop a critical eye for the content that appears before us, and that we encourage our students, our peers, our family members, and the people that we love and care about to do the same. So thank you.